Let's recite Om three times. Take a deep inhalation. Softly open the eyes. Hold on a second. Where do I see the waiting room? Okay, we'll always start with this invocation to sage Patanjali, and you can look at the screen, and if you're familiar with it, you can close the eyes and sing along. It's a little tune to it, so you can read it along and try to sing it along. Inhale. Yogen chittasya padena vacham malam sharirasya ch vaidyakena yopakarottam pravaram muninam patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi patanjalim pranjaliranatosmi. And I always like one of the new members to read this aloud, the English translation. Maybe Jackie, can you read this aloud, please? The English translation below.
Sure. I respectfully bow down with folded hands and offer my salutations to Sage Patanjali, the highest among the Munis sages, who has presented the remedies for removing the impurities of the body through his treatise on Ayurveda, of language through his treatise on grammar, Patanjali,
Mahabhashya, that's okay.
Thank you. And the impurities of the Chitta minefield through his treatise on yoga.
Very good. Excellent. Okay. So we I noticed there are several people who are new here. That's fine. You're most welcome. So, namaste and welcome, everyone. It's wonderful to have you all. Laura just joined. Okay, very good. Okay, Ritu, I still don't see your video. What's happening? Oh, now I do. Okay, so what we'll do is before we start, we always like to do a very quick introduction, set of introductions. Tell us your first name and last name, where you're located, and why are you here today? What brings you to this session? Okay, so I'm going to go through the list in alphabetic order. So we'll start with Ashish.
My name is Ashish Bhateja. I'm located in the Philippines. I've been here for about 6 years now. I am here because I'm interested in learning more about the Yoga Sutras, also trying to read a bit about Bhagavad Gita and see if I can see the connections in a better way than I understood in the past. Thank you very much and look forward to the session.
Very good, Ashish. Excellent. Thank you. Next is Becca.
Hi, I am Becca Michael. I'm in Raleigh, and I was connected to this training as part of a yoga teacher training program that I'm doing with a couple of my cohort on here today. I so enjoyed one other before, and I thought that it was a really rich way to get into the language and understand the sutras in the context when they were written in a better way. So, looking forward to being here.
Very good. Thank you, Becca. Okay, and then Eleanor.
My name is Eleanor Lee, and I'm in Cary, and I'm here today just to learn more about the sutras and the processes that go through our mind to create stress and understand all that. So thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Okay, Jackie.
Hey, I'm Jackie, and this is my cat Chloe. She decided to join. I'm in Raleigh, and it is part of our curriculum. I'm in the yoga teacher training with Becca, and I think Jessica's on. So, and last month was really, really helpful in dissecting, I think, the sutras. So I'm really looking forward to today as well. So thank you. Okay.
Great. And great to have you back, Jackie. And Jessica.
Hi, I'm Jessica Marshburn. I am in Wake Forest. I am here also along with the yoga teacher training. But part of what even got me to yoga teacher training was just I'm on a spiritual journey and finding myself and my purpose. So I think this will be a great way to really help with that and get further into that and deeper into everything. So yeah, well, thank you.
Hopefully that will happen soon. Okay, Jackie. Let's move on to John.
Hi, everybody. I'm in New Jersey, and I don't know. I've been finding, reading, and learning more about the Yoga Sutras over the past year or so. I don't know. It's just helpful. It's helpful on a daily, on a sort of daily basis, and sort of trying to crack the code of being alive, floating around on planet Earth. And the opportunities that Subhash has offered to learn more about it and hear other voices comment on it to get me thinking about what Patanjali was writing. That's why I'm here. Try to learn more and try to figure things out a little better than yesterday.
Good. Thank you, John. Laura is next.
Hi, I'm Laura Capoletti. I live in Cary, North Carolina. And I've been studying the Yoga Sutras with Subhash for several years now. And every time I join in, I learn something new. And I'm also taking a Sanskrit course recently, so I'm learning a little bit about the language and the grammar as well. Nice to meet everyone.
And she has also memorized the sutras by heart in Sanskrit. So, you know,
Not all of them.
Pretty much. That's excellent.
Thank you.
Okay, Linda. Let's go on to Linda. You're muted. You have to unmute. Yeah.
I'm Linda, and I'm in Cary, and I'm also interested in learning more about the sutras, and I feel that I'm on a spiritual journey as well. I like that word or that phrase, and it has enhanced my spiritual journey so much. And I appreciate your teaching, Subhash.
Thank you. I appreciate your comment. So glad you're enjoying it. Thank you. Next is Naren on my list. Naren.
Hi, everyone. I'm Naren Dariyavanki.
How do you spell your last name?
It's Yellanki, Yellanki.
L-A-N-K-I?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, go ahead, please.
Yeah, so I'm located in Cary, North Carolina as well. I don't know, probably 2 years ago, Subhash, I met you at your home. not sure if you remember, but, you know, I've been getting your emails, wanted to always join, but never had a chance. Today, I thought I'll definitely come join and learn more about the Yoga Sutras and, you know, trying to connect the spiritual journey as well. So,
very good. Thank you, Naren. Welcome. Glad you're here. Okay, next is Om Prakash.
Hello, namaste, everyone. My name is Om Prakash Sanduja. I live in Maryland. It's called Clarksburg near Frederick, if anybody's aware. And I have started doing my Ayurvedic practice in Clarkville. Since 1 year, I'm a graduate of Kerala Ayurvedic Academy. I'm from California, so I'm still a student. I learned that the Ayurveda and yoga is a lifelong learning. You take at least 2 lives to learn the complete thing. So that's what I'm trying to. I just started my journey. I am retired from pharmaceutical, long career of pharmaceuticals. So based on my knowledge of science and to understand the disease very thoroughly, so I'm able to link the Ayurveda practice and yoga along with the science. So that is a benefit to me. That's a gift to me. And so I am dedicating my life now to giving back to society to see that how I can alleviate some suffering in people's life and improve their life. And I always say anybody who, we are not allowed to call them patient, we call them rogi. So any rogi come into clinics and I tell them my first goal is to put a smile on your face. And I want you to keep smiling, not here, but when you go back and I can teach you how to smile and keep smiling.
Good.
That is what my small sutras what I keep learning and applying to rogis. And I'm successful a little bit. How did I find out about Subhashji? So somebody mentioned to me a word called Karma Klesha and Pragnya Parada. Pragnya Parada is in Bhagavad Gita chapter 2 and Karma Klesha is also part of Bhagavad Gita. And I was looking at the website what the Karma Klesha could be. What could be the suffering because of your karmas? And I found, Subhashji, your presentations. And I found it was so intriguing, so original, so scientifically written. And I bowed my head to you that you work so hard to collect all those information into one presentation, which is available for everybody to see. It is amazing. So I say namaste to you again.
Thank you. And thank you so much. Very kind.
Session.
Very kind words.
Yes.
Thank you.
The first time when I learned the meaning of yoga was from Arun Deva, who was one of my teachers in Kerala Ayurvedic Academy. And the first thing which I learned was yoga doesn't have to be uncomfortable. You need to be comfortable while doing yoga. And I always declare myself, I feel ashamed that while I was in India, I did not understand the meaning of yoga. And now that I'm here into this field, I do understand. I want to understand more and learn myself so I can teach others to make their life easier, flexible, and happy. Thank you.
Thank you. Wonderful. And finally, Ritu. I can't hear you, Ritu. Is there something not... It's not, it says it's connecting to audio, it's not connected yet, no. Well, I guess we'll get back to Ritu once she is able to connect to audio. And... we still cannot hear you now.
Hello, can you hear me now?
Yes, now finally, yes.
Oh, sorry. I think I had to connect to the internet audio. Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Ritu Bhatia, and I live in Morris Hill, North Carolina. And I have learned yoga from Subhashji, and I wanted to learn something more about the Yoga Sutras. So here I am, and I hope and I thank you, Subhashji, again for giving me this opportunity to learn more from you. And I hope I'll continue this journey, you know, with you and with all of you.
Very good. Thank you
so much.
Appreciate that. Thank you. Welcome, everyone. Did I miss anybody? I don't think so. Okay. So what we've been doing is to go through these. I think we started the journey of eight limbs of yoga a few weeks ago, and we've been studying that. I'm assuming everyone is somewhat familiar with the Yoga Sutras. Or there's somebody. I'm not sure about Naren. How comfortable are you with the? Not at all.
Not sure how much. And I keep hearing stuff here and there, but I don't know whether those are Yoga Sutras or those are different. So I don't know.
Okay, that's okay. Yeah. And Ritu, you're also joining for the first time, right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Okay. So just a very, very kind of a brief and a very quick overview of Yoga Sutras, just to get you kind of started. Okay, so this is a text which is written by Patanjali, as you all know. So Patanjali is the author. And it goes back several thousand years ago. And it's all about the mind, as we saw in this invocation. It says, you know, Patanjali gave us the science of physical health through Ayurveda, speech through the science of, you know, through this grammar, and finally mind through yoga. So it's all about the mind, basically. So yoga is about the mind, and Patanjali recognized that all the problems that we have, they arise because of our mind. And so he decided to give us this whole science of yoga so we can work on our mind, understand the mind first of all, and then see what the deficiencies are, what the problems are, and then eliminate those problems. And you can call it whatever you want to call it, a mental journey, spiritual journey, it doesn't matter. They're all the same. Because eventually the goal is to get to a spot where the mind is free of all the agitation, all the suffering, all the pain, and then we are free. You know, that's the whole purpose of yoga, is to free yourself from all kinds of bondage, all kinds of afflictions. Okay, so that's the purpose of yoga. And then Patanjali has given us this whole text called the Yoga Sutras, which has 195 sutras, statements. And they are all organized into four chapters. And the first chapter talks about the whole overall concept of yoga called Samadhipada. And then second chapter is Sadhanapada, which is where we are now discussing the eight limbs of yoga. That's the second chapter. Third is called the Vibhutipada, which is all about understanding the kind of the supernormal powers that one can attain through the practice of yoga. And so he goes into great depth about those supernormal powers. That's in chapter 3. And chapter 4 goes into more depth about understanding what that final state of the mind is when you actually have attained the final state of samadhi, and then you try to go deep into it. Okay, what is that state? What does that mean? Kaivalya, that's called the Kaivalya Pada. Okay. So, so in this second chapter, we started by first understanding what these five, Patanjali calls them klesha. Klesha are suffering, the afflictions, what gives us stress, what gives us pain. Okay, those are the five kleshas, which starts with ignorance, not knowing my true self. It's called avidya. Okay, so it starts with that and then goes into a discussion of these five kleshas. And then it goes into a discussion of the theory of karma. You know, karma is all the actions we do, and then all the reactions that we get out of our karma, you know, all the actions that we do. And karma also leads into this whole discussion of reincarnation, rebirth, etc. Okay, so that's all in chapter 2. And then in the middle of chapter 2, it goes into a very great depth discussion, in-depth discussion of this whole concept of the Sankhya philosophy. Okay, so Sankhya philosophy is, which is the kind of the basis or the underlying, you can call it the structure, foundation for the philosophy that Patanjali has developed after that, okay? So we did a fair amount of discussion on the underlying concept of Sankhya philosophy. That's a part of chapter 2. And then it finally leads into this whole discussion of what causes all the suffering. Eventually, you know, the whole idea is to purify the mind of all the impurities, of all the junk that we have in there, so that when the mind is purified, we are then only able to see through the mind, kind of getting into the depth of our being. That's where our pure intuition is. That's where our pure intellectual being is. And that's what eventually makes us connect with our true self. Okay? So that's what Patanjali gave us as the introduction to these eight limbs of yoga. So what he said is, hey guys, try these eight limbs of yoga and you're good to go. Okay? That means you will be free of all your suffering. But just by practicing these eight limbs of yoga. Okay? So what are these eight limbs of yoga? We went through that. So I'm going to switch over to my presentation so I can walk you through that. Let me share that screen again. Okay, so are you able to see the screen, right?
Yes.
Okay. So, you know, this is something that we already covered in the last couple of sessions. So I'm just going to very quickly run you through this program, I mean, this whole slides. So this one is where Patanjali lists the eight limbs of yoga. But before that, so what he says in this sutra is number 28. It kind of introduces you to the concept of these eight limbs of yoga. So he says, by the practice of these eight limbs of yoga, the impurities will go away. The mind's impurities will go away. And there dawns the light of wisdom. This is what we are looking for. The pure light of intuitive wisdom. Not the wisdom that we consider coming through the intellect. That's not the wisdom we want. Okay? It's the pure wisdom that lies at the very deepest core of our being. Okay? And that's the intuition that we are looking for. And that's what will eventually lead us to our pure discriminatory understanding of what's right, what's wrong, what's real, what's unreal, what's true, what's untrue. That's the kind of the clarity that we want, that without any doubt, without any confusion, we should know what's true, what's untrue, what's real, what's unreal, all that stuff. And so that's what he says, that if you go through these eight limbs of yoga, you can get there. Okay, so these are the eight limbs of yoga: yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. Okay, so yama is the five, you know, the restraint, and we will quickly go through these lists also. Yama and niyamas, then asana is the physical posture, pranayama is the breath, you know, the breathing practices, pratyahara is how to train the mind or how to train the senses so they don't interact with each other. The mind is relieved of any input, any influence from the five senses. That's pratyahara. Dharana is the ability to bring the mind to a single point of focus. Okay, that will eventually lead us to meditation. And then finally, samadhi, which is the final absorption state where the only thing that's in the mind is what you are focusing on. Just one item. No other item can enter your mind at that time. I mean, that's the goal. You know, when will we get there? Who knows if we ever get there or not. That's the goal of yoga. Okay, and then, so these are the five yamas. Ahimsa is non-injury or non-violence. It's sometimes called non-hurting. So you don't hurt others as well as yourself. Satya is the truthfulness. Asteya is non-stealing. Brahmacharya is continence. And then aparigraha is non-hoarding, non-greediness, non-grabbing things. Okay, those are the five yamas. And these are universal. What Patanjali says, there are great vows. You know, it's like taking a vow that you will follow these guidelines and you stay with that. You know, don't digress from them. And they should not be limited by class, place, time, or circumstance. So situation, life should not dictate, oh, this situation demands that I can tell a lie, it's okay, or I can steal something, it's okay. You know, none of that is allowed by Patanjali. Allowed in the sense, he says, if you want to achieve the goals of yoga, follow these guidelines. You know, don't violate them in any way. Okay. Okay, and then these are the five niyamas. Shaucha is cleanliness. Santosha is contentment. Tapas is austerity. Swadhyaya is self-study, and Ishvara Pranidhana is surrender to Ishvara or God or some supreme reality. Okay, so those are the five niyamas, and this is a very beautiful sutra which says that when you are bothered by something that's negative, when you are angry, when you are feeling jealous, okay, when you have no control over your emotions, at that time, you know, this all will come with practice. That you, if you can think of the opposite feeling, okay, so if you are angry, can you think of love? Things like that. If you want to hurt somebody, can you think of compassion at that moment? It's hard. But that's what he says, that with practice you can develop that aptitude where you can apply suddenly an opposite thought. And that will help you develop, that whole sequence of yamas and niyamas. You'll be able to follow them. Okay? He calls it pratipaksha bhavana. Okay? And then, what he's saying here is that when negative thoughts or acts such as violence are caused to be done or approved of, so either you do it yourself, or hire somebody else to do it for you, or even allow things to happen, you know, don't do anything. That's all. It's eventually going to lead you into mental pain. That's what he says. If you think of that, then you will not violate these beautiful guidelines. That's all he's saying here. Okay? So, think of the consequences of your lying. If you tell a lie, what are the consequences? Think of the consequences if you hurt somebody. Think of the consequences if you steal something. Okay, if you do that, if you keep in mind that it's all eventually going to lead you to suffering, then you will be, hopefully, you will not do that. Okay, so stay away from these negative things. Okay, so then we last time in the last class, we started with the discussion of these five yamas, and the first thing we discussed was ahimsa. That's the only thing we discussed last time. Then we stopped after that. So, violence is what we discussed last time. Oh, am I recording this or no? Hold on a second. Is it being recorded?
Yeah, it says recording.
It says recording.
Okay. Where?
I don't know if that means it's recording, but it says it's recording.
No, because I don't see that mentioned here on my screen. Where does it say recording? I don't know. Anyway, if you read that, that's fine. Perfect. I'm also recording it on my audio recorder, I hope. Yeah. So this is a much cleaner audio version. So we talked about these different ways to understand this whole concept of ahimsa or non-violence. That's what we discussed last time. Okay. So ahimsa is, like I said, non-hurting, not causing injury to others as well as ourselves, And so we kind of try to explain what it means to hurt ourselves, hurt others, and hurt the environment and all that. So that's what we discussed last time. All right. So now we are moving on to what we are starting out today. This is the discussion starting with satya. Satya is truthfulness. Okay. So, as I mentioned last time, what Patanjali has done, okay, he has completely did not find the need to define these things. He did not define what non-violence is, ahimsa is, what satya is, nothing like that. He did not define anything, he did not explain anything. What he went ahead and did was, for each one of these, if you are a strict follower of these values, what kind of attainments you can get? What can you achieve if you follow them strictly? What is it that should be followed? I'm assuming he has kind of, you know, he has been, and the whole assumption is that he's talking to his students, right? And these students have been with Patanjali for a long time. They have undergone a lot of study with Patanjali. So they already know what satya is, what ahimsa is, what non-stealing is and all that. So they all know that. But now he's just trying to tell them, what do you achieve? What happens when you are actually there? Okay? So what he's saying here is that to one who is established in truthfulness, actions and their results become subservient. That's the sutra. All right. So now, what I want you to do is to... You're still on mute. That's okay. Okay? But I'm going to split all these sutras into individual Sanskrit words. And I want you to repeat them after me as best as you can. Whether you can repeat it or not, that's fine. Okay? Just make an effort. All right? So it starts with satya. So repeat after me. Satya.
Satya.
Pratishthayam.
Pratishthayam.
Kriyaphala.
Kriyaphala.
Ashrayatvam.
Ashrayatvam.
Okay. So this is satya pratishthayam kriyaphala ashrayatvam. That's how you read that whole sutra. All right. So now what does it mean? Satya is the truthfulness, right? We said that satya. What is pratishthayam? One who is established. One who is fully ingrained in the concept of satya. Pratishtha means to be there, you know. You have been established in that. And what is kriya phala? Kriya is the actions that you do. And phala is the outcome of your actions. So kriya phala, all right? So ashrayatva means that they are under your control now. Okay, so you are able to give them ashraya, means you are controlling them basically. So then once you understand the individual words, Sanskrit words, then it is easier to understand the meaning. Okay, so what it's saying is that once you are fully and deeply ingrained in the value of satya, truthfulness, that means you have understood every aspect of satya and you are absolutely committed to it, 100%, then you can control what the actions you want to do and even the outcome of those actions. Normally, you see, if you look at anything, right, even Bhagavad Gita or any other studies that you do, even Yoga Sutras, you know, they will tell you that you have no control over your actions. I mean, no control over the outcome of your actions, right? That's what the Bhagavad Gita it's all about, that you are only committed to your actions, your duty, and let the results happen. Okay? But what he's saying is that for one who has totally gained that level of truthfulness at the very highest level, okay, then you know what the outcome might be. Okay? Now this is a very high state, you know, so that's what he's saying. Okay? But let's understand some of the concepts related to satya. Alright? What does it mean when we say speak the truth, not the untruth? So These are the notes that I have prepared based on reading, you know, a few of the commentaries by different authors. Okay, because these sutras are so cryptic and so brief, it's sometimes very hard to understand them unless you refer to some commentaries. You know, hopefully they give you some idea, some in-depth wisdom. All right, So that's what I've done here. So speech and mind. Okay. Once they are you able to read this? Okay. I mean, I'm not sure if it's visible clearly.
Yes, we can read it.
Okay. Wonderful. Just want to make sure. I hope I just want to share if it's too small letters or something. Okay. So speech and mind, whatever you say and whatever you think, it should conform to reality. Okay. What's reality in this context? You know, we receive input through the five senses, right? We hear something, we see something, we touch something, feeling, etc., etc., all right? So there are five senses, and we constantly, we're receiving input through the five senses. Now, then, whatever is the information that we have received, we are trying to communicate to others through speech, basically, all right? Or even otherwise, you know, through speech, action, or even mind sometimes, you know, you can transmit through mind also. But if we can transmit or relay back information without any dilution of the content, without mixing anything into the content, all right? So just to take a quick example, all right? You know, we were sitting in a room and I'm sitting with my face facing the window, and the other people are sitting with their back against the window. So, you know, and I see somebody walking across the door, outside of the window. Okay, somebody is walking across, and I can see the person; others cannot. But they can all hear the footsteps. So somebody asked, "Who was that who passed by?" And now, you know, I looked at the person. I knew it was Ritu. Okay, Ritu Bhatia. All right. Now, I said, "Hey, this was Ritu. Oh, that's that terrible person who gave me hell last time I met her." Okay, that's the statement I make. Right. Now, what does that mean? Is this the truth or untruth? The truth part is only as much as I say that it was Ritu Bhatia. That's it. After that, everything is untrue. Because then I'm adding my own salt and pepper to my understanding. And that's what the ego is, what makes everything untrue. That's the whole purpose of this statement, that you have to conform your speech to reality as seen, inferred, or heard. Okay? So seen, when it says seen, it's actually all the five senses. In the yoga, even in the Bhagavad Gita, etc., when you read these words, when they say seen, it refers to all the five senses. That's just the way of saying that, okay? Inferred, okay, now I'm going back to chapter 1. Remember, there are three ways mentioned there to gain knowledge, gain information. Does anybody remember those three? Let me test now. This was in the very early sutras, chapter 1 sutras, 5, 6, 7, etc. Anybody remember that? What are the three ways to get correct knowledge?
Well, direct experience is one.
Uh-huh.
Trusted source.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Number two, yeah.
And then, inference. Like,
yes.
If I woke up in the morning and there was snow outside, I know that it snowed that night.
Yes, very good, yeah. So that's called inference, right?
Yes.
So the Sanskrit words were pratyaksha, anumana, and agamaha. Pratyaksha, anumana, agamaha. Those are the Sanskrit words associated with it. Pratyaksha means direct input through the five senses. Anumana is just like Greg said, that you already have knowledge about something in your mind, and based on that, you can infer more, you know, further information. And agama is, you know, something that you trust as the true source of knowledge. That's something like, you know, the text like Bhagavad Gita or the Vedas or the Bible or whatever you trust in. So those are the trusted sources of knowledge. So what it is saying is that the speech should conform to these three forms of understanding that you have. Remember here, nothing has been added by the ego. Okay, that's the whole idea here. Okay, so action, and then action that we do also should convey the reality as it is. Okay, now speech should not be deceptive, first of all. You know, it should not be deceptive, confused, equivocal, barren of meaning, or hurtful. Right? So, these are the, you know, you make sure that the speech is very, you know, clean and present, and it really reflects what the reality is. Avoid unpleasant truth or pleasant untruth. There's a very famous statement in the Manusmriti. This is, you know, an ancient text. In Sanskrit it says, Satyam bruyat, priyam bruyat, na bruyat satyam apriyam. Okay, so what it says is, Satyam bruyat, that means speak the truth. Priyam bruyat, that means speak the pleasant. So whatever is pleasant to the other person, speak that. But na bruyat satyam apriyam. Don't say that truth which is unpleasant. Okay? And you can take examples of things that happen in life where we, you know. So it is, avoid unpleasant truth or pleasant untruth. All right? Pleasant untruth, a quick example would be, give an example of pleasant untruth. Anybody? We do that all the time. Pleasant untruth. Somebody give me an example.
I kind of thought of when someone asks if, like, their outfit looks good or something.
Yes, exactly.
And you don't want to tell them that, no, it doesn't look that good.
It's good, yeah. You look awful. You don't say that. Oh, it's great. Yeah, you're looking super. Okay. And that's pleasant untruth or unpleasant truth. An example of unpleasant truth.
Telling somebody something, even though it's truthful, may hurt them.
Yes. Can you think of an example?
I actually had a personal example. I remember a friend of mine, he was a musician, and he recorded an album, and he was asking me what I thought of it. And this is years ago, and I remember telling him that the first four songs were terrible. And I was trying to be truthful with him because he's a good friend of mine.
Ah.
And I realized it really took the wind out of him when I told him that. To this day, I really regret that. But it was an unpleasant truth, you know.
Okay.
I would handle it differently now, I think.
Good, good. Well, yeah, so those are the examples. Good. These are some of the things which are mentioned in the text. Now, you know, ideally, you know, if there's something unpleasant, if you don't want to communicate something, just stay quiet, you know. You know, just don't say anything. That's probably the better thing. So give up luxury of imagination in favor of pure objectivity. We know that, right? We start, like I said, you know, we start imagining things, forgetting what the reality is. And then through the imagination, which is, of course, we are very good at imagination. We are very strong in imagining situations and words that come to mind through imagination, and then we speak that out. That's untruth. So, like I've always mentioned, false ego, that's what is hiding the true voice of intuition. Ego. Ego comes into the picture. Ego brings in that likes and dislikes. That's the one which says, oh, I don't like Ritu Bhatia. You know, I don't want to have anything to do with her. All right? So, I'm picking on Ritu today.
Fine, I can take that.
Okay. So, and then of course everyone has their own perception of truth. This is what's called the relative truth. You know, we all know relative truth. I mean, when I was playing tennis, for example, for me, the truth was that it's a beautiful day when it is bright and sunny and no wind, okay? And that was my truth. And for somebody else, you know, now I'm in that situation now when I grow my vegetables. If it's been bright and sunny for too long, my plants begin to die. So that is a truth for me is this is terrible, you know. I want some rain. For a person who's interested in tennis, that's not true. Yeah, these are just some examples, all right?
Subhashi, can I ask one question in between?
Sure, sure. Everyone, please ask questions.
Yeah. Yes.
So on the perception and the reality, so in the past, you know, especially working in corporate climate, you will be perceived as the other people are seeing you working and behaving, but that's not a reality. So when I say your perception is your reality, I get kickback from people. So can you just elaborate that, you know, not only the perception from one person to other person who live together, but for a person who's unknown, how would he or how would I perceive that this is not reality unless I know the facts? So just a thought, if you can elaborate. Thank you.
Can you give me an example of what you're saying? Pick a situation so I can elaborate on that.
So, for example, you're working on a project, and there are four people working in a project, and you happen to be a little bit slower, and maybe you're an overthinker or you are a kaffa personality, you're not even presenting your views, and then you're perceived that you are useless. And so that perception, which is not a reality, but you're perceived as a not hardworking person. So this is the best I could come at this
point. Okay, so, you know, again, there are things that we can do. Obviously, we have to try and understand the real situation. What's the reality? Once you understand the reality, that's what you want to present to the others, that, look, this is the reality, all right? So it's a matter of developing a deeper understanding. When you're working in a community, when you're working in a situation where more people are involved, then you have to develop that a common understanding at a level that everyone is comfortable with each other, all right? Now, if you are being perceived as being slow or not working up to their expected level, analyze your own self first. Is that the truth? Am I slow? When you, if you say if you're kapha, vritti or something and you're slow, explain it to them. Look, this is my natural tendency. I'm doing my best because my natural tendency is such. Therefore, it might give you the perception that I'm slow, but I'm really not slow. I'm doing the best I can. Okay? So it's a matter of developing that understanding. But analyze yourself. Patanjali is talking more about your own self. Analyzing your own situation in life, understanding yourself, and then projecting what the reality is. And then once you are very convinced of what you are and the truth about yourself, it's much easier to convince others as to, look, this is what reality is, and this is what I am, this is who I am. Okay? And then you can work, you know, together. Does that make sense?
Yes, I think we are in control of ourselves and not others.
Absolutely, yes.
That's what I think, and we should be focusing on, as per Patanjali.
That's what Patanjali says, you know, that's it. That's right. Thank you. Okay. Now, there are some situations, you know, when we say something, but the listener fails to comprehend what was said because of frailty of energy or confusion, the speaker is exonerated. Then it won't be called a untruth, just because the listener did not understand, based on the listener's limitations. Okay, then you are not at fault. But if you convey something which is different from what was seen, then it is telling the truth. And then, like I mentioned earlier, you know, then if you use language which is barren of meaning, and then you start using foreign language words or uncommon or vague expressions, you know, sometimes people use very flowery language which nobody understands, you know. And like in this one, Yoga Sutra, for example, when I'm explaining, if I start using all the Sanskrit words just to impress you, you know, that I know, you know, I know Sanskrit, without explaining them, okay, that would be considered as untruth in a sense, okay. So people use, you know, foreign language, like somebody say, oh, French and German, you know, they start injecting foreign language words without explaining what they are. That's untruth. Some vague expressions people use sometimes, you know, all these things. What is this here? Story about neighbor's dead rabbit. Okay. I had put this in here. So how untruth can cause immense pain. Anybody remember the story? Dead rabbit being put back in the cage. Anybody remember the story? Has anybody heard that story? No. So I think, if I remember it right, it goes something like this. You know, there are two neighbors. One guy has a dog. The other neighbor has two rabbits. And they are both in a cage. Rabbits, usually at night, they are in a cage. All right? So the guy who had a dog, he goes out for the weekend. Okay? He goes out for the weekend. In the meantime, one of the rabbits dies, you know, whatever the cause. So, you know, these two ladies who own these rabbits, they dig up a place and then, you know, they bury that rabbit in the backyard. That's how it goes. So the rabbit is buried in the backyard. So this neighbor, you know, who had a dog, he comes back after the weekend and he's, you know, trying to go to sleep at night. Now, and he suddenly hears his dog kind of murmuring at the outside of the door. So when he opens the door, what he finds is this dog had actually pulled that rabbit where it was dug up, and then he brought that dog to his door. This guy is really alarmed. This guy says, "Oh my God, my dog killed the rabbit. What would my neighbor think?" So he takes the dog from the dog. He takes the rabbit from the dog's mouth, washes it up thoroughly, cleans it up, brushes the hair and all that, and then goes back and puts back in the cage. Puts it back in the cage. And, you know, the assumption was that when these neighbors wake up in the morning, they will think that the rabbit died its natural death, you know, something like that. Now, next day, these two ladies come, you know, crying, you know, loud to this neighbor. He said, What happened? Oh, man, you know, something, the strangest thing has happened. You know, we buried this rabbit in the ground because it was dead, and suddenly it reappeared in the cage. I don't know what's going on, and, you know, with some spirits playing some role or something. You know, we are frustrated, we are very upset and all that. So that's the story, I think. How untruth can cause immense pain. So this guy tried to cover up the problem, basically. Anyway, I hope it makes sense. Okay. All right. So that's the satya part. Anybody have questions on truthfulness or comments? Anybody want to say something?
Yes, I have a question.
Yeah.
So truth can sometimes bring a lot of pain, right? So is it wise? Is it like, you know, so what does Patanjali say? So should we let, you know, I mean, ourselves suffer through the pain, or should we just avoid the truth?
Give me an example again. I like examples.
I don't know. I mean, it could be like some emotional, you know, I mean, somebody has said something to us or something, you know, I mean, some situation has caused us some pain. So should we, you know, just face that truthfulness? I mean, you know, that, okay, you know, this is something that this actually, you know, it's the truth. I mean, you know, so it's maybe, you know, just, yes, this is something that it's like a destiny or something, or just completely just, you know, shy away from it, or, you know, just...
No.
Don't go into it, or, you know, just don't face the situation. So this is what, I mean, I'm just confused about. So should we just because it's truth, should we just face it, though it could be very painful?
Is it, again, you know, this is exactly, you're right, you know, you're getting to the real crux of the problem here. Okay? That's exactly what Patanjali is talking about. Truth is painful. Why? Because of the ego. Because the ego has certain likes and dislikes. Okay? Ego always assigns something that it likes. It always assigns something that it dislikes. What is presented to you, it may not match with what you like. If it matches with what you dislike, it's going to cause pain. All right? And that's why what you're saying, that truth is hurtful because it is matching something that we don't like, which already has been labeled as I don't like it, right? That's the situation. Now, the whole purpose of the practice of yoga, and that's what Patanjali says, follow these eight limbs of yoga, so you'll purify the mind. The word purify here literally means that you will not be influenced by these likes and dislikes. and you will be able to absorb the situation exactly in its reality without getting the ego involved. So what you're saying, truth hurts, right? They say truth is always painful. Why is that painful? Because of the ego. What does the ego do? It tries to match things with what we have in our mind, in our subconscious levels. We already embedded deep in our level, this is what I like, what I don't like. Right? Truth is that if you wake up in the morning at 6 o'clock and practice yoga every day, okay, you will be in better health mentally and physically. That's the truth. All right? Come 6 o'clock, you have already set the alarm. Okay? Who wakes up first? Ego wakes up first. Okay? Ego says, I don't like this. Okay? It puts the alarm into the snooze mood, okay? Snooze, and then goes back to sleep. Never wakes up again. So you know that truth is something that's hurtful because it's going to give you discomfort of waking up at 6 o'clock, getting ready and doing some yoga practice. That's the truth. But it's painful. Therefore, ego listens to what it likes, not what is right for it, only what it likes. And therefore, it goes back to sleep and you are in pain. You are in more pain. So the idea is to avoid a certain instant, short-term pain, you are causing long-term pain. That's the whole idea. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So think of it, all problem related to ego, basically. Nothing else.
I have a question.
Yeah.
You said that each person needs to work on their own individual self and learn that so we can have the truth of our own reality and not be influenced by other people's reality.
Mm-hmm.
In the current situation with the pandemic, it seems like everybody has a slightly different reality of how serious the situation is.
Mm-hmm.
So you could hear people's viewpoints about what you need to do, and you could waver between their different realities. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Right.
But you have
some people are going out and doing more things than others because, as far as their reality is concerned, it's safe to go out and do anything.
But again, you have to stick to your own reality, right? Develop your own reality to the sharpest possible, value, and then stay with that. As long as it is not cluttered by your own ego. So the information is pratyaksha, anumana, and agamaha, right? Pratyaksha is what you hear from the five senses. Anumana is based on inference, again based on what your previous knowledge is. And agamaha is these, something which is a trustworthy source. Again, whether the Wake County office is trustworthy or your next door neighbor is more trustworthy, that's up to you to decide. Who is your agama? Who is your trustworthy source of information? That's what you'll work on.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
Yep.
But Subhash, within that, like using the COVID example, there is an empirical truth somewhere in there, right? There is a truth as to how some level of risk of the disease, right? And then we all, our ego, if I'm understanding correctly, our ego then filters how we perceive it. And our ego is oftentimes creating this, what we're calling a reality, but it's really just our ego's interpretation of external information. It is not necessarily the empirical truth. Does that make sense how I'm saying it?
Yes, exactly. It's very true, yeah. But then
Wade County or whoever, the CDC or whoever, they're being influenced by egoistic influence as well.
Sure.
So that may not be, if that makes sense.
No, again, how far do you go in terms of analyzing and deciding what the appropriate what the appropriate agama is? Is CDC the ultimate truth?
No.
So we don't know the ultimate truth, right?
Yeah.
So it is your own best understanding of, based on your own pratyaksha, anumana, and agama. That's what you will decide on. Those are the three sources, right? Pratyaksha is the direct inference, direct information. Anumana is inference based on previous knowledge. And agama is who you trust.
Yeah. If moving to a different subject along these lines, as we're going through this and talking about this sutra, for instance, I'm an attorney. One of my requirements, my ethical obligation, is to be a zealous advocate for my clients. And they say that in within the court system, there is a search for the truth, right? In seeking justice, it is a search for the truth. But candidly, oftentimes when I'm zealously advocating for my client, I'm spinning things sometimes to be as favorable for my client as possible, right? Because that is my ethical obligation within my professional constraints, right? And then oftentimes we go to trial and there is a jury that is the arbiters of the truth, right? They're the ones that are supposed to come down with it. Almost inherent in there is that my adversary who's advocating for their client is putting forth a different, quote, truth than the, quote, truth that I'm putting forward to this panel of arbiters who then conclude what the truth is. And those three different truthful conclusions are usually very different. It's interesting. So I'm taking pause right now as we're going through this and acknowledging that oftentimes what I'm doing is skirting the truth in a Patanjalian way, right?
That's true.
I don't think Patanjali would like the way that I'm proposing the truth at times, if that makes sense.
I agree with that. That's the dilemma. That's the dilemma you are in.
I may have to change my profession if I study too much of these yoga sutras.
Every profession has those dilemmas, I would say.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's like not just the legal professionals. I guess we face this thing almost every time.
You know, this is a constant. Learning process that we have to go through. You know, like we said, the more we understand the mind, the better off we are in terms of dealing with these situations in a more effective and productive way. You know, it is time. You know, it's time.
What I try to keep in mind is that we are supposed to do our duty and our responsibility, but not be responsible for the fruits of our actions.
That's exactly what the Gita says. Yep.
Yeah, that helps me in some of those situations.
Absolutely, you're right, Laura. Very good.
Subhashi, is the truth that is referred, and just kind of taking John's example, is it absolute? Because depending upon my own sources, it's my truth. So if I'm a lawyer A, that's lawyer A's truth, and lawyer versus lawyer B.
Absolutely.
And then the court decides their version of the truth, which is their duty.
That's what John was saying. That's exactly the right thing. Yep. It's hard. It's not easy.
So the question I have is, as a lawyer, if a client comes to me, my job is to protect the client, and I would put the truth forward in such a way that it's protecting the client. But I know deep inside that, that's not the truth. So am I doing justice there, or am I not doing justice?
That's why John said he might have to change his profession.
Exactly. That's the problem. That you may see me wearing pink robes next time on this call.
There's no answer to this, pretty much.
There's no answer in the sense that you pick a client, first of all, who is telling you the truth, In that case, you have to pick a client who's telling the truth. If you know the client is not telling the truth, how do you deal with that? I mean, just because you've been given a certain amount of money and you protect the client, even though you have to tell a lie, again, that's, how you understand the whole situation. If your conscience, if your buddhi, if your intellect is okay with that, look, this is my profession, this is my living, and I'm allowed to do a certain untruth, if you're absolutely comfortable with that, go ahead and do it. If not, change your profession.
But even someone who's guilty has the right to competent representation in the legal system. So
yeah.
You can look at it that way. You have a duty to even someone's guilty is supposed to have a fair defense, right?
Sure, yeah. But then,
and just to be clear, for everybody that does not know me on this Zoom call, I'm not the type of guy or lawyer that runs around lying to advance my client's interest. But I'm just saying, at times, in the effort, like with anything, you know, you're trying to have your children do the best thing possible for themselves, and sometimes you may push the issue a little bit to hopefully steer them or encourage them into right direction or right action. And we know Santa Claus, you know? you know, we tell our kids about Santa Claus and Easter Bunny and all of these kinds of things for many, many years. And, you know, it's for fun and it's for good stuff, but, you know, it's not the truth by any stretch, you know?
They find out.
A few words for me. So Subhashi was telling that three bases of what is the pratiksha, which is the proof, and then anumana, and then the other one is trust for the source. So when a lawyer, to my view, is presenting an argument, so it's based on the source which he or she has. And also, whatever his intellect or what his experience really has, the experience, add into that, and that present the truth. So, John, you're not doing anything bad. You're based on your proof and based on your intellect and based on your similarity and experience, you're presenting the truth. You're not doing anything bad. So I'll leave you that.
Very good. Excellent. Okay.
Great. I can go back to work on Monday. Thank you.
Okay.
This conversation has me thinking about all of the ways, I mean, because we've been talking about expressing truth in our speech, and it just occurs to me that there are a lot of other ways to communicate outside of that, and like through our actions, how we live truth, how you know, arrange your life, and you might, just because this happened to me recently, I just realized that the way I was spending my time didn't at all reflect the values that I would have said with words were my values. And then it also gets at just, you know, the ways that we can be untruthful that way to ourselves. And just also thinking about truth in a greater sense. And this is maybe taking it way out there, but just, you know, beings that aren't human beings, and the truth that, you know, beings want to live and exist, and that's not expressed with language as much as, like, existence and how things live. So I know that's, like, rambly and not asking questions so much as just...
This is a good way to, you know, this is exactly, you know, what we want to do, you know, is to think about these values and how we apply these to our life. And, you know, you're absolutely right that we don't necessarily, you know, just say everything in words, you know. It's how we live our life. Is that true to our values, true to what we understand, true to what we value as the ultimate truth for me and my life? And you're right, you know, that's how we have to eventually evolve ourselves. I mean, communication can be not just through speech. It can be through action. It can be even mental, you know. When you look at somebody and somebody knows that you are angry without saying a word, without doing anything, you know, it's just through expressions. So, you know, you reflect all these things through our words, actions, and speech. And then our own lifestyle, you know, that... Are you encompassing everything truthful? So, very true. Yep, very good. Okay, should we move on to the next one? Asteya. All right. So, the sutra is, again, I'm going to read the words one word at a time, and then you can repeat after me. Even if you're on mute, that's fine. That's actually better, because otherwise it'll be confusing. Asteya pratishthayam sarva ratna upasthanam. Okay, so asteya pratishthayam sarvaratno upasthanam. That's the whole sutra. And again, I'm going to break the words and give you the meaning. Asteya means non-stealing. The word is steya. Steya means to steal. And when you add the prefix a, it makes it negative. So non-stealing, asteya. Pratishthayam, remember it's the same word that we used in the previous one, satya pratishthayam, same word. That means one who is fully established, one who is completely ingrained in that value of asteya. Sarva, sarva means all. Ratna, ratna means all the precious jewels. Ratna is all the precious jewels. That's the literal meaning of ratna. Okay? And upasthanam, that means they present themselves. So, when you are fully established in non-stealing, then all the precious jewels, they present themselves to you. So, that's the meaning. What does that mean to you? You know, it's everybody's individual interpretation what that might mean, you know. So, to me, when you are fully established in the practice of yoga, you don't need a whole lot, you know. Then, you know, you have no greed, then you have fully santosha. All these are applied then. Santosha, you know, the contentment is there. There's no greed. There's no reason to hoard anything. So what do you need the jewels for? So whatever happens, whatever comes to you, you think of it as a jewel, as very precious. That's it. Be happy with that. I'm assuming that's the meaning. That's my understanding. Otherwise, who needs jewels? If you are a yogi, what do you need the jewels for? Anyway, so that's the meaning here. The one who is established in asteya, or established in non-stealing, all the jewels, all the ratnas, all the gems, they will present themselves to you. That's the meaning.
So, Sabaji.
Yes.
So you're going to a grocery store, and you see that the cherries have come to the market, and you pick up one piece just to taste it. Is it asteya?
Well, you know, if you just want to taste a piece of cherry, for example, right? To me, it's probably just a question of asking the guy who's standing there, you know, who's taking care of the store. Is it okay for me to taste one?
Yeah, I stop doing it. Even if I ask somebody, he says, no, please go ahead. I don't do it unless I pay for it.
Well, you know, if you think, you know, for example, you know, if you want to taste it, you know, ask somebody, and then if you taste it, that's okay. You know, to me, that's not stealing then.
Sure.
Yeah, that's a good observation, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. So the notes that I have made are taking something not belonging to you, and you take it forcefully, deceitfully. Okay. Unjustly, illegally, etc., that is called stealing. And then to forego or to forsake any such desire, that's called non-stealing. Asteya, that's the value that we want to imbibe in our life. Asteya, okay? So anything that we can try to claim illegally, deceitfully, unjustly, forcefully, etc., etc., you all know that. I think this is fairly easy. Bribery, for example, charging more money than the set or the just price, using work, property for personal use, etc. They are all forms of stealing. I think we all know that. When some of these, we tend to do them unknowingly, you know. To give an example, everyone works for some corporation or some job, and we use the work property for personal use. We all do that. Anybody give an example quickly?
Yeah, I'm using my office laptop to, you know, watch this, you know, to join your Zoom session.
There you go. That could be considered as as stealing in some sense.
I have come to believe, maybe because of my gray hair, that the temptation is there. So it is up to us how we subside our temptations and the desires of those things. Those are the causes of all suffering,
right.
And instigate to make you stealing. So I think it's a question of, so we believe we are in this class to learn these things, and we are here for a reason. So we have intention to not to do those things, as
right.
Patanjali has mentioned. So I'm blessed. That
right. No, no. For example, Ritu, you're using your office PC for this call. And at the same time, you know, you can kind of justify that, look, you have to use your office PC when you're out of the office hours also. Sometimes you're committed to do that. So in a sense, you know, if you can mentally justify, not illegally, but, you know, properly, if you can justify it and tell your mind that you're not doing anything illegal or not doing anything out of stealing, intention of stealing, but for the purpose of doing your job properly, that's it. And then you can use the same computer for your office work when you're not in office time. Something like that. I don't know.
So I have a question, rather a doubt. You know, in Mahabharata also, we have seen some instances where Krishna, helps, Arjuna and, his brothers to kind of contrive some truth, for the bigger cause, for the greater cause, for humanity or for, so is that acceptable? So Patanjali says that it's fine. If we do certain things which are not, which do not basically abide by these guidelines sometimes, for the greater cause or something.
That's a very, very good question, and it's a difficult question to answer, because these things are happening at a level which are way above my level of understanding. My intellect is very limited, right? And Krishna is sitting up there, who is the supreme being, the superlative being, and his intellect is way, 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 way more than what, any one of us can have, collectively even, all right? So what he is trying to decide as the truth, which to me it seems like untruth, again, is it for me to judge? Am I at a position to judge it in reality just because, I'm trying to judge it with my intellect, which is very limited? Okay? So, it's a very good question, Rita and, Ritu and I've had the same questions, very similar questions. You read the Gita or some of the other texts and, there are things which Krishna does there which are, in my mind, not proper. But then, again, he's doing it at a level which is way up above. I don't know. Can I question that? I don't know. Maybe once I reach his level, I'll be able to question it.
in today's context, we can just put it, the normal life. If we have to do certain things, to save, say not ourselves, maybe our kids, he's doing something and, you want to teach him a lesson, you want to tell the truth, but, it's going to cause more harm to him. So is it okay to save him or to, or just let him face, because, that's the truth or, that he has done something that, so what's the right thing to do in that scenario?
Again, it's again, right thing is what you will decide is the right thing, right? How will you decide it? Is your ego involved in that? Are you telling something because you think that's the right thing without realizing it's the absolute truth or not? Okay? So the question comes to whether it's my pure intellect which is working or it's my ego is involved. Am I involving my raga and dvesha, my likes and dislikes into it? And then I'm communicating something which I think is the truth. Okay? So that's all that you have to decide eventually. And that comes with a lot of practicing these eight limbs of yoga. That's what Patanjali is saying. Practice these eight limbs of yoga. Continue to cleanse your mind. Continue to purify your mind so that the ego does not pick stuff from the likes and dislikes. I'm going to keep repeating that same word because this is exactly the the crux of this whole Yoga Sutra. Because we think something that we are telling the kids is the truth, but that may not be the truth. It may be, you know, like I said, spiced with our own salt and pepper.
So see, that's the thing, you know, our experiences make our truth.
That's right.
Right?
Yes.
And we think that's a truth, but it may be a lie. And our kids think us to be the, you know, our role models, or they think what we are telling is the truth.
Right.
Right? So what we preach or teach our kids, so should we always self-doubt ourselves, you know, so it's just kind of been confusing. Being a parent, I mean, I face a dilemma every day.
Yeah, no, there's no reason to self-doubt all the time or anything, you know. You have to, again, as long as you continue the practice of yoga, your mind gets, you know, cleansed out slowly. It takes time. It's not going to happen in one day or one week or one month. But then, as you go along, then what comes out from you is more and more closer to the ultimate truth. Okay?
Swashi, probably to me it sounds like maybe the process is more important than doing a fact check. So if telling about Santa Claus brings in kindness, then the process is well intended. So it's not important whether Santa Claus is true or not true, but ultimately the process and the intent is true.
Well,
and if that reinforces kindness, then that's probably the right way.
That's nice, yeah, that's good.
And Subhash, I think there was another time where we were having a similar discussion about a parenting issue came up, and you said something that struck home with me, and maybe it may make sense here. Again, going back to the ego taking over is always the dangerous part, and acknowledging when the ego is controlling versus the intellect. And being able to discern between those things, which is not always possible because the ego can be so powerful. But if the ego is calling the shot in making whatever the decision is, it can be further away from the truth.
Yep, very true. Yep. All right, very good. So, again, just continue with my notes here. Greed or lobha, which is another one of the values that we will be talking about, greed, and desire, raga, they cause, you know, us to steal, which is, you know, something that we like, something we don't have, and we desire it. There is a strong desire, so we decide to steal. And I have, again, a few thoughts on my own. Arriving late for a meeting, you're stealing somebody else's time. That's very common. We always end up doing that somehow. Developing non-desirousness helps resist the temptation for objects of the senses. Making demands in the relationships is stealing. Okay, so when you have expectations and you make demands in a relationship, that's stealing somebody else's values, basically. Now, what Patanjali says is, through the practice of Asteya, all treasures, you know, like I said, all jewels, that's the literal meaning of ratna, jewels and gems, they will be at your disposal. So that's the stealing part, asteya. Okay? Anybody have any other thoughts before we do our...
One more thing, sorry. I think I'm taking up too much of your time.
No, please.
So, you know, I mean, so I have noticed that, you know, whenever there is any, you know, a pandemic comes or something, you know, so everybody starts hoarding things, right? I mean,
yes.
So because we want to make sure that we have enough of everything for future. So will that be called stealing?
I would think so. In my opinion, yes. That's both greed, that's aparigraha, that means you're violating aparigraha, which is non-hoarding and greed, and it's also stealing from somebody else who absolutely needs it more desperately than you do.
Okay.
So in my mind, that is so. That is exactly, that's what I think, yeah. Very true, very good example, yeah. So it's violating two values, you know, asteya and aparigraha, which we're coming to. Okay? All right. So if there is no other thought, we can, you know, what we normally do is we go through 5 minutes of silence. You know, we sit there and just kind of meditate on something, you know, with very perfect silence. And everyone can put themselves on mute. And then we'll do our closing mantras, you know, closing Shanti mantras. So stay back. Just sit quiet for 5 minutes.